Tov, we can start it. So a few months ago, I contacted Atara Is, and I said I'd like to Ice. I'm sorry, and I'd like I haven't met her yet. So, but I know she's in charge of the Yoetzot Halakha program. So I just asked her. I said we want to bring a top Yoetzot to our conference that we're running this year in medical ethics. So she right away told me to invite Lori, which we did, and it's been a pleasure working with her over the last couple of months. She teaches at Nishmat. It's been a Yoetzot Halakha for already many years, one of the veteran Yoetzot. She has a degree from YU. She served as the Shoel Umeshim. How do you pronounce that in feminine? Shoelet Umeshiva. That's Baruch Hashem, the strides that women have made in learning are really unparalleled in our generation. And she was a Jerusha scholar, and it's a pleasure to have her from Efrat, even though she misses her family, her five kids at home. But we're thankful she's here. And Bakasha, Lori.
Thank you. Is this audible? Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. Thank you, Ilana. Thank you also to everyone who played a part in helping me come here and for creating this conference. So thanks also to all of you, because you make the atmosphere. Unfortunately, the sheet that I prepared did not print well in the booklet. So you're going to perhaps need to focus a little bit more on the listening than on reading along. But Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll get somewhere. And the truth is I wanted to start with something that's a little bit of a thought experiment in any case. We received the following question, which is by no means an unusual question for us to receive. On the Yoetzot website a few years ago. I want you to listen to the question and think a little bit about how you might respond to it. The questioner writes, my husband and I are having terrible fights when I'm in Anita. I had hoped that this time for us in Anita would strengthen and deepen our love. Now I am disappointed in the Anita experience. As you can tell, I am a newlywed. I don't know what to do. Do you have any help or suggestions? I'm thinking we can be a little interactive because we're a small group.
I guess I would first just sort of talk to her about what did she learn about, like, who, I don't know, just try to figure out how she was taught or where they're coming from in terms of how they behave with each other during the Anita experience. In fact, like, what did she learn about it and how does it look like? So I have an idea in my mind what their household might look like during that time, and just
okay, great.
I don't know where she came from or who she learned from or she read in a book, or I'm trying to just, that would be my first just to explore what she knows about it and what's happening in her
household. So a good first step would be to try to figure out who is this woman, what's going on in her marriage, what did she learn, what is she talking about.
And did they always do it, or did they evolve so in their marriage already?
Mm-hmm.
How did they come to be religious? Like, even those things, like,
okay,
become relevant, I think.
Right, all different levels of background can be relevant.
I was going to say that definitely one goal would be to try to get it not to be just a physical relationship. Because if it is just physical, then of course, in the Nida time it's very difficult, but hopefully there would be more to the relationship than that.
Okay, so somehow try to help this woman find a way to enhance the emotional relationship for the time when the couple is, when the woman is in Nida. Have you thoughts? Yeah.
What are they fighting about, and why isn't it an issue when she's not in Nida? Yeah.
Okay.
Have they been suffering to get pregnant? Are they working on that? Is that an issue?
Are there other issues? How does it relate to how they're relating to each other in general? You have some other thoughts?
Whose idea was it to follow Taras Mishpacha? Was it a together decision, or was it his or hers, or what?
Okay, was this a mutual decision, or are they on the same page religiously? Yeah.
I have the the opposite problem. I'm a therapist. It's a Hasidic couple, and the husband insists on touching her, if not having relationship with Dafka when she's in here.
Well, we have, unfortunately, this is not, Maim Ginuvim Yimtaku. there are many cases, and unfortunately, I think signs are that perhaps they're even increasing in just in terms of questions that we get of couples who have difficulty during it, and for some people can even develop some kind of a fetish or particular interest at that time, which can complicate the situation. And some other thoughts? Let me broaden the question a little bit, okay? If we forget about this particular questioner and we think about the issue at hand, I imagine many of you in this room are married or have been married. But even if you weren't, you've heard different things about Nida at different points in time. How is Hilchot Nida presented in terms of how it's going to affect the couple? And how do you think that that presentation jives with reality?
Well, I think I dealt with this issue a little bit when my daughters were in college classes, and when one of them came home, had the most negative, that it was all rules and laws and lots of no's, and I was like, wait, where's the hashgafa? and she said, I don't know. Where's the hashgafa? And I went out and found her another college teacher because I was just very, I was very upset that that's all that she was getting, and I was very concerned if that's all that she did get, that it would just, it would be a horrible experience for her. And I started talking to friends about the sort of ratio of halacha versus hashgafa that girls are getting. And there seem to be differences among college teachers.
Okay, so you're making two very important points. One is that sometimes the way Hilchot Nida can be presented can give people a lot of halachic tools, but not necessarily hashkafic tools, or not even hashkafic tools, let's talk about practical relationship tools. There was a question about how it's presented and how we put that into practice, how that looks, how it feels for us. Additionally, we have the factor that not only is the presentation of Hilchot Nida often decisive in a couple's experience, at least their early experience of halacha, but the way that Hilchot Nida are presented varies greatly from teacher to teacher, and even to some extent from community to community, and that's not even taking into account the natural variations that come when any student hears what a teacher says and takes it in his or her own way. So just in terms of framing the question, before we get started looking at sources, the question, the question that I'd like us to focus on is the question of how Nida observance affects the marital relationship, looking chiefly, to start with at least, at different sources that give us some sort of indication from within our texts what we can find. And then I want to come back outside of the sources again and think about what we can learn, what the implications are of what we've read for how we can think, talk, teach, relate to people in different opportunities we might have. For ourselves or for our children or friends or what have you to help in terms of these observances, because we know that it's going to affect the couple's relationship. And I think that's the baseline assumption before we even look at the sources. That's the baseline assumption I think we've all been making, and I think it's hard to deny that Hilchot Nida does have a decisive influence on how a couple relate to each other. Can be positive, can be negative, can have different influences at different stages in the couple's marriage, but it's, as it were, it's a player. It's a player in what the religious marriage looks like. No less a player than a lot of other factors that might sometimes get more attention. So if you want to try to follow along in the sheets, it is in the booklet, but unfortunately the words got printed a little funny, so if some of you that might still be worthwhile, it's on page 37. For some of you that still might be worth trying, but the words are not broken up properly, so I can't say for sure. The first source comes from the Gemara in Yevamot, and it's a general idea about husband and wife interaction. It has to do with the husband and how he relates to the wife. Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis taught in a Baraita, Ha'ohevet ishto kegufo, v'mechabda yoter migufo. Alav ha'katuv omer, v'yadata ki shalom olecha. This source means, someone who loves his wife, a man who loves his wife as himself, and honors her more than he honors himself. Upon him, the verse says that you should know that your tent is a tent of peace. This verse, which comes from Sefer Iyov, actually continues to say, Ufakata navcha velo techta, and you will remember your dwelling place, and you will not come to sin. And this verse is brought in a few other contexts. It talks about how a man who does not have a wife is like someone who dwells without shalom. It talks about how a man who doesn't sleep with his wife is as though he's a sinner, because the end of the pasuk says that if he will remember as to remember the times that they're supposed to be together, he will not come to sin. It comes to teach us that a man is supposed to sleep with his wife before he goes and leaves on a trip, if he can. What's the idea here about the couple relationship? Why am I bringing this out? Because I think oftentimes in our texts, for example, many people might be familiar with texts about kibud av va'em and how the father might get precedence in a case of conflict over the mother, because everyone is required, the mother is also required to honor the father. There might be a misconception in our sources that's not a mutuality to the level of respect that's required. There's a whole level, I think Rav Bilka is going to deal with this, I would imagine, more extensively in his talk. There's a whole level of mitzvot ben adam l'chaveru, of how we relate to anyone, the ethics of how we deal with each other, which also are very much in place within a marriage. And not only are they in a place, but within a marriage they might be in some ways heightened. You want peace in your home? You honor your wife. The question is how that honoring expresses itself within the marital relationship in a way that's unique to the marital relationship, and how it expresses itself during the time of Nida. The second source I brought is from Sefer Vayikra. This is the prohibition against sleeping together when the wife is in Nida. V'elishav Nidat Mata, lo tikrav, megalot erbata. And to a wife in the time of her ritual impurity in Nida, do not approach to uncover her nakedness. The situation of Nida is unique in that Nida is a combination of two different realms of halacha. On the one hand, we have the world of ritual purity and impurity. It's a world of halacha that's largely lost to us nowadays. On the other hand, we have the world of prohibited relations, which is still very much in force nowadays. What's particularly interesting about it is that if we think about other prohibited types of couplings that are mentioned in the Torah, usually there's some sort of moral opprobrium attached to them. Not uncovering the nakedness of your father's wife, parent, child, bestiality. These types of examples are all seen as inherently some sort of negative or unholy type of a sexual relationship. The Nida relationship is unique within this list because, of course, this is the one sexual relationship that the Torah really wants to foster and encourage. And yet still, even within that relationship, there's a time period where sexual relations are off limits. And it seems that it's not a moral issue or a sociological issue, whatever the reasoning is. It can't be that there's something inherently negative about a husband being with his wife. Of course not. But what we're saying is that this particular ritual impurity creates a situation where this couple can't be together. So on the one hand, it lives within the world of prohibited sexual relationships, and on the other hand, and this is the tension that can often be experienced in the marriage, this is also the only sexual relationship that is permitted. There is no other appropriate outlet. It's an unusual thing to say simultaneously that something is the only outlet, and then to say that outlet is not available during the peak years of a woman's fertility, unless she's pregnant or nursing, for not quite, but almost half the time. On a Torah level, it would have been somewhat less in terms of how many days. But still, we're talking about something that's very natural, becoming a Nida, that's 100% expected for a healthy woman. And okay, it might have been that women were pregnant and nursing for longer intervals at earlier points in history, so that overall a woman would have experienced menstruation less frequently over the course of her life. But even so, Even so, this is something that any couple would expect to experience. And thinking about it from the outside, not from the world of our experience, it's very confusing. It's very confusing to put up there with all of the other prohibitions of sexual relations, relations between two people that are actually meant to be together. We add to this a very notable word within the pasuk. It doesn't just say don't approach her nakedness. I'm sorry, it doesn't just say don't uncover her nakedness. Lo tigale ervata. It says lo tikrav ligalot ervata. Don't approach to uncover her nakedness. This is the word tikrav, to remind you of the word kirva, korban, nearness, proximity. There's a certain type of distancing that this pasuk is referring to beyond just putting the sexual relationship of women. The question is how that's supposed to play out. Now, why do you think that might be the case? Meaning there are, in general, we do talk about, there's a summary pasuk about the incest prohibitions, you know, the types of sexual relations. It uses similar terminology. It says, ish ish akol shar b'soro, lo tikravu legalot erva, an yeshem. There is a summary pasuk about prohibited incestual relations that also uses this term, lo tikravu, don't approach. What does this build into the prohibition? Offense in what way?
Well, you can't even come close, you know, so not to, I mean, to distance yourself to such an extent that perhaps more than is legally required, but if you get too close, then the temptation will be that much harder to resist.
Okay, you use some very important key words, and I just want us all to think about them for a minute because they're loaded. One word is temptation. How does temptation play a role here? And the second word you used was legally. It's going to be very difficult to define lo tikrav legally. Again, we're not just talking about a prohibition per se. This is all forever. We're talking about the main positive sexual relationship in someone's life. And now we're saying it's not just relations in themselves that are prohibited, but something approaching relations. And defining that is not going to be simple. If we take into account what the, we were talking about this earlier, what the emotional experience is of the relationship, we realize this gets only more complicated. The Gemara, and the third source I brought, is this is a favorite of college teachers everywhere. Haya Rabbi Meir Omer. Rabbi Meir would say, Mipnei ma amra Torah nida l'shiva. Why does the Torah say that a woman should be nida for 7 days? Original Torah law was that if a woman menstruated at her anticipated time of menses, it was a 7-day time period, and then she would go to the mikveh. There's an additional Torah law that has to do with the woman who has uterine bleeding at different times of month from when she would expect to menstruate, and that woman, if she sees it for 3 days consecutively, would then have to count 7 clean days. Nowadays, we have conflated those two categories because it can be so difficult halachically to differentiate between them. It's not just a matter of menstruation or not menstruation. It's a matter of colors of blood, amounts of blood, how blood is found, etc. All of these things, that we have any time a woman has any bleeding, we have the 7 clean days. But originally it was just a 7-day time period. Now in the 7-day time period, Rabbi Meir asks, why should it be? It's already interesting that he's asking why it should be. In other words, he's not asking, why is it that Anita is prohibited to her husband? He's asking, why do we have the 7 days? And the 7 days is, of course, rooted in concepts of purity, ritual, purity, and impurity, where 7 days is kind of our standard unit. He's asking, how does this fit in? How does this make sense? And he suggests an answer. Mipnei shevagilba v'katzba. Because he gets used to her and he gets sick of her. Did you notice something? From whose perspective is this being written? Very much being written from the husband's perspective, right? He'll get sick of her, and Amra Torah, for that reason, the Torah said, Tehet me'a shivat yamim, she should be in her status of impurity for 7 days, kidei shetehe chaviva al ba'la, kishat knesata l'chupa, in order that she should be beloved to her husband, and the level at which she was beloved to him at the time in which she entered into the wedding canopy. two questions. Question number one, do we think that this logic can flip? Meaning maybe it's intuitive for Rabbi Meir to be speaking from the husband's perspective. Do you think this also works from the woman's perspective or can work from a woman's perspective?
Yeah.
You do.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm just thinking of sometimes it's nice to have a break and not be physical. There may be different levels of interest on the part of the woman and the man, and so sometimes that will be, she might feel quite happy at times to be separate.
Okay, so something similar could work out for
or
a woman.
Or that she gets sick of him, I suppose.
Right. What's interesting, going back to the word you used, Tova, of temptation, this is taking the idea of temptation or the challenge of the fact that the Nida relationship is the one positive sexual relationship within our tradition. Sorry, the marital relationship is the one positive sexual relationship within our tradition. And this says that that temptation can actually be useful as well. Temptation can lead to sin, God forbid. Maybe that's part of why we have to prohibit as well something approaching relations, but temptation can also be something positive for the relationship, creating some kind of a cycle within it. Is this something that works primarily on the sexual level, or do you think it can work on the emotional level as well? You brought up emotions before. What do you think?
I'm just thinking if you're sort of minimizing the sexual, the physical relationship, then you're hopefully enhancing the emotional relationship.
Okay, so in the absence of a physical relationship, maybe you're filling it in with emotions. Is that what Rabbi Meir is saying? Work on the emotions. Okay, so it's interesting. It seems to me that there are kind of two directions you could go with this. I'm sure there are more, but two main directions in which you could go with this. One direction would be to say, just as the physical relationship is supposed to sort of go through a cycle, so too the emotional relationship perhaps is supposed to go through a cycle. Another approach might be to say, no, the physical relationship takes a break, and the emotional relationship fills that gap. Yes, you have a comment?
How many wives did Rabbi Meir have?
That's an excellent question. So it is true that that in the time of the Tanaim, you could still, in theory, have more than one wife, but interestingly enough, we don't have a lot of records of polygamy. It does not seem that polygamy was the norm at all at that time period. I'm sorry?
Whose wife was it also important?
Okay. His wife was? Bruria, who was in her own right a particularly learned woman who knew how to who knew very much how to answer for herself. Okay. Now, one of the interesting features of Nida is that I'll put it this way: we have some Ethiopian students at Nishmat, and the custom in Ethiopia among the Jews. They actually maintained a lot of the practices of purity and impurity, but those practices also got mixed up with different local practices and local debates between the Jews and the Christians in Ethiopia. It's complicated to understand too much what's reliable or what's not reliable within that particular tradition. But in Ethiopia, a woman who was a Nida would go into a Nida hut. Now, her tent. Now, we had at Nishmat, at one time, a student whose father, who lived in some, they had come and made Aliyah to some development town, was one of two Ethiopian men who had come to Israel and had erected their own Nida huts. He made a Nida hut in the parking lot in order to enable his wife to continue in the tradition of not living in the house while she was in Nida. That is not, however, the norm that we find in rabbinic texts. And if we think about it, it's not obvious that it shouldn't be the norm. If we're not supposed to approach having relations, in general, if there's someone we're not supposed to have relations with, we have a prohibition. What's the prohibition of being secluded with someone that you're not supposed to have relations with? Prohibition of yichud, right? Why is it the case that a woman and her husband should be allowed to have yichud together at a time at which she is prohibited to him. The Nirahat might make sense if we think about these things from the perspective of Yichud. Well, the Talmud in Masechet Sanhedrin discusses this. There was a heretic who said to Rav Kahana, challenging him, Amrito Nida Sharli Yichudei Bahadei Gavra. You say, you rabbi, say, that a Nida is permitted to be in Yichud along with her husband. Eshar Esh bin Oret Meina Me'achevet. What, you can have fire and flax and they're not going to burn up? What are you thinking? How is this legitimate? Amar Le, Rav Kahana's response, HaTorah He'ida Eleinu Suga B'Shoshanim. The Torah gave testament to us, to Bnei Israel, that we are what you call Suga B'Shoshanim, fenced in with lilies. This is, of course, a reference to Shir HaShirim. Sha'afilu K'Suga B'Shoshanim, even when the fence is as delicate as lilies, Lo Yifritzu Behen Pratzot, we're not going to burst it open. If we unpack the statement a little bit, we see the same tension. This is the one appropriate sexual outlet, and on the other hand, when it's prohibited in full, just as any other prohibited sexual relationship is. And here we see a tension and a balance. On the one hand, there is a thought to say that the best way to deal with this would be to separate the couple. On the other hand, when we say that a Jewish couple continues to live together while during the Nida period, in effect, what we're saying is that there's a sort of intimacy between the couple that is maintained no matter what's happening with the sexual relationship. So this might be a partial answer to the question about Rabbi Meir and about how he understood these. There's some sort of emotional link that is important to maintain, it would seem, that would allow for there to be yichud even when the wife is in nida. And there's an idea that the couple is going to be controlled. What else? What else should govern the relationship during Nida? Well, there's the question of how the couple interacts. We know what they're not doing in an absolute Torah level, but what are they doing, or what else might they be able to or not be able to do? So it's interesting. There's a Gemara in Ketubot that talks about things that a wife does for a husband. And there's certain things that a wife might do for her husband around the house that if there's hired labor, if they're wealthy enough a couple, she could pass along to somebody else. But there are three tasks that she can't hire out, no matter how much hired labor they have. And those same three tasks get raised in the same sugya with respect to Nida. Amar Rav Yitzchak Bar Chananya, Amar Rav Huna. Rav Huna said, Kol melachot she'aisha osa lebala, every type of labor that a woman does for her husband, Nida osalabala. She continues to do for her husband while she's in Nida. In other words, it's not just that they continue to live with each other, but that the house continues to function the way it's always functioned. Again, this is different from the Ethiopian practice. It's interesting where the woman basically gets the time off. The rest of the community cooks dinner for the week, all that type of stuff. Chutz mi, what are the three exceptions? Mezigat hakos, hatzat hamita, v'chatzat panav, yadav, v'raglav. The three things that can't be hired out are also the three things that a woman who's in Nida can no longer do with her husband. These three things are mezigat hakos, mixing him a drink, hatzat hamita, making his bed. By making his bed, we're talking about also plumping up the pillows, making it nice, setting it up beautifully for him. V'chatzat panav yadav v'raglav, washing his hands, his face, his feet. What seems to be the idea here about the relationship during Nida?
So when she's Nida, she can do those things?
She can't. Right. She can do anything else, but not those three things.
Acts of intimacy. Enticement.
There's a certain type of intimacy that's off limits. What's interesting is I don't know how much it's about enticement. It's an interesting question about if these things were seen as specifically enticement. But there are things that are seen as intimate. How do we know that they're seen as intimate? They're so intimate that she can't hire someone else to do them for her husband. These are specifically the prerogative of the wife to do for her husband. But when she's in Nida, she can't do them for him.
And so he has to do them himself because he can't hire them out.
Presumably. Again, we see this tension. There's a way in which we're supporting or defining the intimate relationship, and there's a way in which during Nida that the intimate relationship doesn't function as usual. In Masechet Avot Rabbi Natan, we have more details about how husband and wife can or can't behave during Nida. Source 6. What is the fence that the Torah made around her words? The Torah says, to wife and the period of Nida, don't approach. Perhaps one would think that you could still kiss, hug, or speak frivolous things, sweet nothings. Talmud Lomar, the Pasuk teaches us, Lo Tikrav. We're looking for a legal definition for Lo Tikrav. What's off limits? First of all, physical affectionate touch that's not just sexual relations. That seems to make a lot of sense, right? Why would that be prohibited? We said it's a siyag, it's a fence. Vidaberim advarim betelim is striking. They can't talk about totally trivial, silly matters. What do we mean by trivial? Are we talking about flirtatiousness? What exactly is defined by betelim is not so clear. It continues. Perhaps she would be able still to sleep in the same bed with him, but she'd be wearing clothing and, you know, it wouldn't go farther than that. Also, that's out loud. This is very striking. Perhaps you would think that the woman would be able to wash her face and put kohl, eyeliner, on her eyes, make herself up. No, there's a pasuk that says she's sick when she's in Nida. This is very strong. In the days that she's in Nida, it should be as though she is nidui, separated out. What's seen as being the opposite of separated out? Making herself up for him. And the source goes even stronger. From here they said that someone who makes herself ugly, less appealing when she's in Nida, the chachamim like that. She gets herself all dolled up. Chachamim don't like that. Now this is a slightly weak formulation. Ruach chachamim no chaymena is not the language of asur or mutar. It's something much weaker. And yet the thrust of this source seems to be Avot Rabbi Natan, that it's not just intimacy. It's not just sexual intimacy that we're looking at limiting. And it's not just specific, well-defined acts, intimate acts, such as preparing his drink, making his bed, but it's even how she presents herself to him and to some extent how they interact, not just physically, but also how the couple interacts in speech. They can all be affected by this. This is very strong. If we were talking about a tension between sort of intimacy and distance, this sort of seems to go much more in the direction of distance, right? Need do it. But to counterbalance that, we have the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. Source 7 from the Gemara and Shabbos. Kidatanya. Hadava benidata. He's using the same pasuk. She is sick in her nidata. Zkenim harishanim amru. The first elders said, Shalotiho, velotifkos, velotitkashet, bevitekzivonim, that she shouldn't put herself in makeup and she shouldn't wear fancy colored garments. They agreed effectively. Here are the zkenim harishanim. That sounds like what we saw in Avot Rabbi Natan. Ad Sheba Rabbi Akiva, until Rabbi Akiva came, Velimed, and he taught, Im ken ata megana abala, if you do that, you're going to make her unappealing to her husband. Venimza bala megosha, and you're going to find that her husband is going to divorce her. This fits with Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is also one who holds that if a husband has already put his eye on someone else, that could be grounds for divorcing the wife. There's an idea here that we're dealing with something very, very delicate within the relationship. The Avot Rabbi Natan seems to be looking very much from the perspective of siyag and taking it to another level. Avot Rabbi Natan is full with concern about the sin of husband and wife being together during Nida, and will go to any extreme to make sure that that's not going to happen. Rabbi Akiva is saying, we're dealing with something very delicate here. There is the sin, and we of course have to be very, very concerned about the sin, but there's a thread that's still supposed to connect this couple, even during the needed time period. And if we go too far in our measures to prevent sin, we risk snapping the thread. That's not a risk that we can take. How does this come out in practice? I want to bring you a few different quotes from the Shulchan Aruch, and then,
Lori,
yes.
How are we supposed to understand Rabbi Akiva considering how he lived his life?
Meaning what?
What
okay, well, first of all, there are different traditions. There are different traditions about Rabbi Akiva. It's a very interesting question how the different traditions work together. For example, in Avot Rabbi Natan, the tradition is Rabbi Akiva, when he starts learning, he already has a child. So, but the traditions in the Gemara do seem to imply that that it's Rachel or his wife who sends him to go learn, and then he's distant from her for a great number of years. In those stories, it's repeatedly emphasized that it's her permission. He goes at her urging. In fact, it's a condition she makes for their betrothal. And then he's ready to return. And she says, he hears her saying, well, I would rather he go learn more. And at that, he goes off. So it's not simple, but it would seem to be that it's that in that case, it was driven by his wife. But we also see a different side of Rabbi Akiva. For example, there's a story that he sees Turnus Rufus's wife, and he's struck by, he laughs in part because he's struck by her beauty, but in part because he's confident that someday he's going to marry her as well. And there's a tradition that might eventually happen. So exactly how this worked for Rabbi Akiva, I can't say entirely, but it would seem that there's some sort of awareness here. So we also have intimate scenes between Rabbi Akiva and Rachel in the hay, sleeping in poverty, and he's promising to buy her things to adorn herself with. So I don't know that it's so out of character based on the other things we know. Okay. The Shulchan Aruch. Source number 9. Mutar la'adam na'bit bi'ishto. A man is allowed to look at his wife. What? Why shouldn't a husband be allowed to look at his wife? Well, back to the same way that we talked about yichud is a concern. There are also restrictions on how a man is allowed to look at a woman. A man is allowed to look at a woman respectfully. A Jewish man is not supposed to look at a woman to ogle her. This Gemara, explicit Gemara, that says even if he looks at her little finger, if he's doing it with the purpose of objectifying her, it's prohibited. And he's also not allowed to look at parts that are uncovered. So the Shulchan Aruch is telling us that a husband is allowed to look at his wife, afal pi shehi nida, even though she is nida, v'hi arvalo, and while she is in nida, she is prohibited to be with him. Afal pi sheyesh lo hana'a miriyata, and it's even okay for him to derive pleasure from looking at her. This seems very much to be of a piece with what we saw in Rabbi Akiva, right? That we don't want it to be that the woman creates some reality when she's in nida that she's no longer appealing to the husband. There's a sexual bond between them that we are trying to maintain. He's allowed to look at her and he's allowed to take pleasure in looking at her. Ho'il v'hi muteret la'char zman. Why? So the Shulchan Aruch brings a reason, because she's going to be permitted to him at a later point in time. Gemara's term for this type of idea is what we call pat besalo. It's like he has bread in his basket. He knows that they're going to have a chance to be together again later. And it means that there's an ability to appreciate or enjoy aspects of each other that one might not do with someone who would never be permitted to, because later on, you know, that's going to be an opportunity. If we're talking about, again, this tension between intimacy and distance during Nida, or the prohibition and maintaining a connection as a couple, this is a very important idea. This is an idea that says one of the reasons why perhaps we don't have to go so far in the direction of a vote to Rabbi Natan, that the woman should be as though she's in nidui when she's in nida, is because we really have this confidence, not just suga b'shoshanim, we have a confidence that the couple understands that there's a time for this, a time for that, and that time will come. And the fact that they know that there will be a time for reawakening the other aspect of the relationship is going to give them the ability to negotiate that need a period in an appropriate fashion. Ve'eino ba'ba zeh lidei mishol, so he won't come to a stumble. About lo yisachek ve'lo yakel roshima. He shouldn't play around. Now, play around here might not mean play around. Play around here might mean speak something that's not serious. It might be another term for dvarim betelim. The poskim do discuss things like, can a couple play ping pong during Nida? Can a couple play chess during Nida? How exactly are we supposed to understand and not playing? The lo yakel roshima, kalut rosh is flirtatiousness. You might remember from Pirkei Avot, Rabbi Akiva is the one who says, Schok ve kalut rosh, magilin me'erva. Schok and kalut rosh, not conducting oneself in seriousness, lead to sin. Frivolity can lead to sin. We have other gemaras and sources that contrast schok and kalut rosh with wisdom, that contrast it with doing mitzvot, that contrast it with Torah. There's an idea, though, that what's interesting is from the no, we also learn the yes. These types of behavior would not be okay when the wife is in nida, but we're not concerned about them when she's not. That can be part of their relationship when she's not in nida, even though in some other context we might be concerned that it would lead to sin. Okay, I want to step back now from the sources a little bit. And I want to talk about, overall, the picture that we've got so far, try to put it together, and then maybe take some questions as well. Let's see what you think from the picture that we have so far, okay? What are we particularly concerned about? What do we want to make sure does not happen during the needed time period for the couple?
We don't want the thread to break, as you said.
Okay, so we don't want the thread to break. And at the same time, we don't want them to sin. Okay? It's a very, very complicated dynamic. Now, at the same time, that tension might even be productive for us. That's Rabbi Meir, right? Rabbi Meir is saying, well, if you didn't have this time when you're dealing with this tension, it might not be that the thread would break, but the thread might become very slack. Right? They might lose the connection in that way. It might not really bind them together anymore. The question becomes how we want to take these different, as it were, data points that we've seen and try to conceptualize what that would look like in a marriage dynamic for a firm, healthy couple trying to be scrupulous about Hilchot Nida, and at the same time trying to maintain a healthy level of intimacy. If we go back to our initial question, right? The young woman who talked about how they're fighting every time she's in nida, or the college teacher who's presenting these halachot. What are ways that you might formulate it based on what we've seen? Or what do you think might be concerns or issues that should be addressed?
Yeah,
one of the things that we've seen, if you think about the sources, is that there are some sources that seem to be more addressed to the man, but not all of them. Some of the sources are addressed to the woman. For example, can the woman adorn herself or not? Or how is she conducting herself as well? What is she doing or not doing? And the dynamic that's within there that I think you're referring to is the idea that even in the world of refraining from something, if it's two people who are refraining from something together, that is a joint endeavor. That's no less a joint endeavor than participating in something actively together. Or to put it a different way, to build on what you're, to restate what you were saying, that to refrain from something together can be a positive activity in terms of creating a certain element of kedusha. Okay. Other thoughts?
modern times, to say a woman looks like she should look like she's sick is very negative, and a lot of these laws are based on different, they come from a different time, and they've developed along different ways. When you spoke about the tent, that's probably where all these laws originated, pre-biblical, when women were put in tents, they didn't understand the whole process, and you know, the bodily functions, and then it's incorporated in the Torah, and then we take it to the next level at different time periods, where people lived in different types of dwellings. When I mentioned before, how many wives did Rabbi Meir have? If you live in Israel, you could have, it's not like living in Europe where you lived in one room, and Yichud was a very, it was an impossible not to have Yichud. You couldn't put her outside in the cold. You know, sociologically, we've developed in different ways. And the laws are going stricter, and sociologically, we've gotten more lax.
Okay. Yes, sir. So one of the big questions that we have, and we still have it, is exactly why we have these laws. Rabbi Meir takes a stab at answering the question, right? He says, well, it's to create a certain type of tension or cycle within the marriage. But it's not crystal clear, certainly not from the Torah, why we have this law, aside from the Tumah aspect, exactly what that's supposed to mean. Because we don't really understand Tumah now, unfortunately. It's distant. It's distant from our lives. It's a difficult concept. To what extent sociology came into play? Certainly, it comes into play in describing something like what are the types of activities she's doing or not doing, because those are the activities that were hallmark activities of a relationship at that time. At the same time, I think one of the more interesting things that we can do, and I think it's important to do, is to try to see if we can read from within the sources what the woman's perspective would be, or what the woman's role would be. So, for example, earlier today when I asked, could Rabbi Meir's logic possibly be flipped? And it seemed to be obvious to many, at least to many people in this room, that of course it could be flipped. Of course it could apply to a woman and a woman's experience as well as it could apply to a man's experience. So there are ways in which these things are being discussed, or terms that are being used, that I think in a modern PC context, or in any kind of modern context, would not necessarily be described in exactly the same way. Does that mean that this is one-sided or not relevant? I wouldn't go in that direction, largely because this is coming from the Torah. I'd go more in the direction of trying to understand what could make it an experience of mutuality. We have a couple of other thoughts. I have a few other points to share, but someone else have something they want to say about this? One thing I want to share is that there was a study done in 2009 by Michelle Friedman-Belfer, Tali Rosenbaum, Rachel Yehuda. A group of women did a study on women. It was called Observant Married Jewish Women and Their Sexual Experience. And a sexual life, I think I might be getting the name a little wrong. What they found in the study, they found, there were a lot of interesting findings, but one of the findings was that two-thirds of the women that they surveyed found that mikvah was a very positive experience for them in their marriage. Three-quarters of the women felt that the experience of mikvah enhanced their sexual life within the marriage. What they also found, and this is interesting, was that there was not necessarily a correlation between women who found that mikveh enhanced the sexual experience of the marriage and those who found that mikveh enhanced the emotional experience of the marriage. This, I think, is the real challenge, and it really just gets back to what we've seen. In other words, I think the sources are pretty clear and make a lot of sense about how Nida plays itself out in terms of the sexual dynamic. how Nita plays itself out in terms of the emotional dynamic, I think is a lot more open in terms of the sources, a lot harder to understand. And that's in particular where I think we find more of the variation among college teachers and more of the struggles with couples. When I first started working as a Yuetzet Halacha, and sometimes a woman would come with a lot of complaints and great distress about Nita, sometimes I felt that my job, I really have to educate her. She has to calm down or something like that. I came to learn that really there's a wide variation in terms of people and couples and their needs for different types of expressions of intimacy. For better or for worse, there are people for whom it's inbuilt that it's going to be a lot harder to refrain from physical contact, and there are people for whom that's less of an issue. There are couples for whom that's a greater challenge. There are different stages in life when it can be more difficult or less difficult. What I think is the most important job that we have, and this is for our own marriages and also for relating to Tarat Mishpacha in general with others, is to try to fill in the sort of the gap of understanding how it's going to work to both maintain this intimacy and not step over the line. In terms of modern day halachas, there's a lot of discussion about exactly what it means to be not doing kalut rosh, not litzachek. Is it specifically if it's going to lead the couple somewhere, or is it under any circumstances? There are different communities that have different practices. There are two main paradigms that I'm familiar with for dealing with this. The first is the one that I think is much more prevalent, and it's probably what you were referring to, which is a paradigm that says, look, take Nita as a time to work and build on the emotional elements of the relationship and run with them. That can be effective for many couples, not for all couples. I think there's another paradigm that doesn't get as much attention, and I think it's equally plausible within the sources that we've seen. And the second paradigm might be less about physical versus emotional. It might be more about togetherness versus autonomy. It might be that one of the ways we could think about conceptualizing what we've seen is that to create conditions of intimacy within the couple, there certainly needs to be, at different times, a high degree of togetherness. It might also very well be the case that to maintain healthy intimacy within the couple, there needs to be at different times a high degree of autonomy. In other words, it might be that for some couples, the healthiest approach to Hilchot Nida is very much during the Nida time to work intensively on emotional togetherness. But I think it's no less legitimate, and it's worth exploring that for some other couples, it might be appropriate during the time of Nida for that to be the time when the couple, when each member of the couple pursues more of their own individual interests, does a little bit more of their own thing, and comes back. Both pictures are pictures of a cyclical nature along the lines of what Rabbi Meir is saying. Both cycles are still cycles that are rooted, fascinatingly enough, in a woman's physical cycle. But they're very different pictures. The latter picture is supported somewhat by a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah talks about different terms that are used in different areas to refer to things. And it says that Nida is called in a certain locale Galmuda. Why is a Nida called a Galmuda in this locale? Gmula da mibala. She's separate from her husband. It might be that the time period of Nida is a time to intensify emotional bonds. But it might be that the time period of Nida is a time for husband and wife to explore their separate identities. Whichever path you take, and different paths might be more appropriate for a given couple at different stages in their marriage, or for different couples as you approach them, I think the exercise we did today is worthwhile. Because it's worthwhile to think about, you were talking about the ritualization, how much we do laws by rote. It's worthwhile to take note of the fact that Nida can be affecting us in different ways. And to summarize, or to finish up, I just want to go back to the question we started with. The first thing we said to the woman who asked the question about how does she deal with the fact that they're fighting all the time where Nida is, we said, it's terrific that you noticed that. That's the first step to dealing with it. In other words, there's something going on when you're in Nida that's making it harder for you to keep your shalom bayit. Pay attention, in other words. I think the sources are giving us a lot of room for how we negotiate this tension, and our job is to try to pay attention and create a marriage that's coherent, working with the Nida framework. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, we'll give Lori a little bit of a break, and then we'll hear from her after in the second session with some of the practical things of the Yoetzah. I just want to add things. Most of you were here last night. You heard the introduction to Rabbi Bulka, but a lot of you were, and for those who weren't here, it's really a pleasure. Rabbi Bulka has been in Ottawa, as you heard, for close to 50 years, maybe over 50 years, and the recipient of the Order of Canada, which is the highest recognition any citizen in this country can receive. As he mentioned, and on a personal level, what he did not mention last night is you were the first speaker we ever had for the first ever Torah Motion program. Before it was known as Torah Motion, you and Rivka Blau and Maurice Lamb, if you remember, back in Toronto many, many years ago. So you sort of got us inaugurated, and of course, our families do go back a long time. My father-in-law, Shalom, and you, I know we're close, and it's really a pleasure to have you and a pleasure to be in your city. And it's the first time, really, I'm spending, you know, Shabbos in the area. And yesterday was the first time I was in your shul. I've been living in Canada all my life, not so far, just on the 401, but I've never made it to the shul. So really, thank you very much, Rabbi Wilk, and I will hear from you on ethical responsibilities in the marriage. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lori. In Ottawa, they say très intéressant. Thank you very much, Rabbi Jay. It's actually ironic. Today in Eretz Yisrael, I think it was 9 o'clock in the morning. By now, a lot later, was the Akamas Matseva for Rabbi Maurice Lamb. It turned out. I don't know, at that point in time, how many years ago was it?
But we had, it was 1999.
Well, would you believe that in between that,
I think
yeah, so. My son married his granddaughter. And they're living in Eretz Yisrael. It's quite fascinating. I don't know whether the Shilach came about during the time that we got there. But it's very.
What I forgot to mention is you were the person who took out your Palm Pilot. And you said, Palm Meshesh Tamud over Yado.
Palm Pilot? I never had a Palm Pilot in my life.
No, you must have had
a. I'm still one of these guys who has this.
Okay.
So it's a pleasure to be here. I just want to branch off a little bit on what Lori said with apologies and. The whole issue of how do we teach Hilchos Nida? I think if we made a small little shift, which is just a terminological shift, we probably would send a different message, because the Hilchos Nida translates in English as the laws of separation. I prefer very strongly to have this as Hilchos Oma, which is more the laws of togetherness, because you only can separate from something that you were once together. And somehow or other, I don't know whether this is part and parcel of a syndrome where we focus so much on the things that are osur as opposed to the things that are mutar, and also to talk in terms of the most important part of the marriage is not the time that we're separated. The most important is the times that we are together. And I am sure that every responsible Kallah teacher or Chosen teacher teaches about the responsibilities of togetherness. But those are probably the some of the bigger challenges in marriage, including how together, how to avoid abuse in the sexual relationship, which are very important issues. So I think if we stop calling them Hilchos Nida, not that they are Hilchos Nida, but to say in terms of the emphasis on this being the precious time together and how we're going to maximize that,
so that in the time of separation, you really would want to get back together again. Because, let's face it, there are many people, from my own personal experience, there are some women, some, who actually welcome the Nida period because they can't stand the Ona period. Because the relationship is one which borders on abuse. We'll get back to that a little bit later. But I also wanted to take the opportunity, because timing is everything and Ona is time, in this week's quintessential book of Jewish ethics, which is Pirkei Avot, there's a fascinating statement, which I know is always rankled. It says that Al Tarbe Sicha Imo Isha, which, stupid translation to say, don't talk to women too much, right? And then the Mishnah goes on to say, Bi Ishto Amru. So this was talked about with regard to your own wife. So that means, I mean, if this is the way you're supposed to relate to your wife, so much more so to someone else's wife. But it's a very perplexing thing to say, why would we put a restriction on that? So I think it was Hirsch who made a very interesting comment, which is very important for us to understand. When it says, Sicha is not dibur. Sicha is low-level conversation, gossip, chazarai, unimportant things. So truth of the matter is that in any relationship, these types of trivial matters do come up, like who's cleaning the dishes, who's putting the napkins on the table, all sorts of silly things that you have to take care of. But what the Mishnah is cautioning is don't let that be the majority of your conversation with your wife. Your wife is not just there to do your bidding and to take care of cleaning up and preparing and all that stuff. You have to ennoble your wife. So if you reduce your wife to sicha, that is to say your only conversation with her is this trivial, unimportant, menial matters, then what you're doing is denigrating her, and it's going to bounce back on you, because you're going to wake up one day and say, yeah, I married somebody that I have no respect for, and that can explode the entire relationship. So, because this is part of this week's Pirkei Avos, and because we're doing what we're doing, I just thought I'd share that with you as a launch into this whole issue of Jewish marriage ethics. It's not in the way of self-promotion, but there's another interesting coincidence. Years and years ago, I think it was in 1986, I wrote a book called Jewish Marriage, a Halachic Ethic. Just this week, I got a note from the publisher that it has, I knew it was coming, but, you know, it's like a pregnancy. You know that the baby is going to come out eventually, you just don't know when. So the book just came out this week. I didn't get it in time to bring copies here. Timing is everything, and this time the timing was not so good, but at least it's out, and hopefully it'll be useful now as much as it was then. And how much it was then, I don't know, but I'm going into the whole issue of Jewish marriage ethics. I want to just make a very important beginning point, and that is that Jewish marriage ceremonies are very boring. It's a cookie cutter ceremony. And if you take a look at it, it basically almost has nothing to do with marriage. No one expresses love to the other. There's nothing in it that actually, when you come out of it, you're really inspired. Well, what is there to inspire? It's the same Sheva Brochus. The Brochus are nice. But it's a transaction. Guy gives the girl a ring or something of value, and with it betroths the lady. And then they, depending on the traditions, there's a yichud afterwards. That one, no one actually even sees that. So the marriage itself is basically like a business deal. I have you now because I gave you this. So it's a trade-off. I give you this, now we're together. So we're used to it. You know, when you go to a marriage, what excitement are you going to factor? Every single marriage, it's the same Harayat Mukadesh Atli, it's the same Yotzer HaAdam, it's the same Sameach HaSanim HaKalo, nothing. And the more religious circles that you get, even the type of thing that could make a difference, such as something that the rabbi or someone else might say to the chatan and the kala under the chuppah, forget it. That's not allowed. It's almost as bad as repeating a word in the davening. It's just simply out of bounds. I question that. I think that it's crazy. I think that it's not right. I've made my feelings known, but don't think that there's going to be a real shift in this over the course of the next immediate future. But that's actually where something substantial could be introduced into the marriage, into the wedding ceremony. So ask yourself a very simple question. Why is it like this? We had the ability to construct a marriage ceremony. We know that there were certain things that had to be done, but there's nothing in it. It's almost like lifeless. And my sense is, I have no proof for it, that there's a message that's being conveyed here. It's a very serious message, which is, don't be a fraud. Jewish ethics has in it very many components, but one of them is don't dress things up the way they are not. So, for example, we are told, don't look at the picture, look what's inside. But there's a very strict prohibition, for example, against giving someone a false impression. So, we understand this. For example, to have a layer of oil on top of a barrel of wine and sell it as if it's a barrel of oil, obviously, so it's theft, but it's also deception. You're not allowed to dress things up the way they are not, including, for example, glossing over scratches, giving the impression that an item is new when it is not. This is all in the category of fraud. And it's forbidden according to Jewish law. So there may be a hidden message here that hopefully we have uncovered, which is to say, simply speaking, to whoever it is that's getting married, don't be a fraud. If you put up your best face in the time of the courtship because you wanted to win over, then all of a sudden, now that you've won the sweepstakes, and now you are married, and, well, I got what I needed, and now I can go back to being who I really am. That's a disaster. So you shouldn't be surprised if you see statistics, which seem to be totally consistent over the course of time, that the first year of marriage is one of the most pivotal years in the relationship, and one in which the explosion in terms of it collapsing altogether and ending up in divorce is most likely to happen. There are certain periods. One is the first year. Later on, 7 years down the road is another period. And then even further down the road, when the kids leave, and then they realize now we're stuck with each other, and they have to make a critical decision: is this a good investment in my future? So these are all interesting things that happen. But let's begin with a very simple thing, that you don't dress yourself up as a nice guy when in fact you're not. So of course, not nice guys are not going to take this and listen to it and say, oh, okay, I get it. And they're all of a sudden going to make sure, okay, the picture that I'm presenting to you now is really who I am. But the halacha is very clear. So one of the reasons, for example, why we don't use a stone for the wedding is because of the question of what is its value. And the issue of a person may think, oh, I think I'm getting a stone which is worth $100,000, and it turns out that it's basically very simple and only worth $5. So if a person goes into a marriage thinking they're getting $100,000 worth of stone, and they're only getting $5, that's fraud. Actually, it means that the marital, the validity of this marriage is basically zero. So we got to this minhag, halacha, whatever you want to call it, which is that you have to give something of substance that is not a stone. Basically, a stoneless ring, which has a value which is clear, and the idea of being duped or fooled is severely diminished because of it. But still, there can be all sorts of deceptions. How the deception works, it could be in terms of, let's say, hiding the fact that you were once married, you didn't say anything. It could be in terms of your character traits, that you're not projecting exactly how you relate in stress situations. One of the big issues that's come up today in Shidduchim is the question of history of depression within the family. Depression today, unfortunately, is a plague, which, I mean, that's a topic of for another time. But the idea that we, in this period of plenty that we have in a society which is, at least in Canada, in the United States, in certain places, been as glorious as we've ever had in our history, and yet we should have such an astronomical rate of depression. We're looking at a possibility at any point in time in the population of 1 in 4, or at least 1 in 5, probably a little bit more, being seriously depressed. So that is something that has come up, and issues have arisen in terms of, let's say, a person did have a history of depression and is actually taking antidepressants, but didn't tell the Kala about this, or vice versa. These are really serious ethical issues. So the actual marriage ceremony in itself, as much as it may look like a transaction, is actually saying eloquently, yes, this is a transaction, but it's a serious transaction in which your responsibility ethically is to live up to your hype, to live up to your press releases, to live up to the image that you have projected, which has resulted in the other one saying, yes, I want to marry you. So that's actually critical in terms of how we begin with this. So that would be the ethical responsibility at the very outset. By the way, I can stop here in case you want to ask questions before I go further. If there are any other any questions or comments? So we'll move on. So then the question is, all right, so this is good. I get that. So how do we move forward in terms of the ethical responsibilities in marriage? Because in fact, when you're getting married, there's a package that comes with it. And there are responsibilities inside. Laurie gave and touched on a number of them, but I want to drill down a little bit on this. Let's start simply speaking with the attitude that you have in marriage. This may come as a surprise in religious circles, but it's certainly not something that is prevalent in secular circles, which is that not everyone who gets married with the idea that they're going to be married forever. And then in fact, there are a lot of people who get married with the idea that, yeah, fine, if it works out, good, and if not, I move on. And then you start, this is actually the terminology that is used for this, it's called serial monogamy. That is to say, you have one at a time, but if that one doesn't work, you get someone else. So in effect, it's not that a person necessarily has an affair, but they're going into the marriage not with the idea that it's going to be forever. So what's the upshot of it? Let me tell you, years and years ago, Psychology Today had an interesting Talmud-like test. They actually took 350 couples, and they separated them out. They took the 350 that they said were happily married. What was the definition of happily married? Is that they were together for 25 years or more. By that definition, the Clintons have a happy marriage. Right. So they put them into separate places, and they gave them a list of, I think it was 35 things, and they said, you pick out what you think is the major reason why you're still out together. And fascinatingly, the answer that was given, the number one answer, both by husbands and wives, was we went into this marriage committed to making it work. And that come H or high water, they're going to stick it out. In other words, we didn't go into this with the idea that, all right, if not, goodbye. They went to the idea, we're together now, we're guf echot. That means, that's literally, we're together.
I was just going to say, that's the reason that the research shows couples who live together have a higher rate of divorce after they get married. Because when they started the relationship as living there, that means it's not a full commitment, and they can't flip a switch when they get married.
Yes, so that was, there was a study by Schopen and Boderich years and years ago, which, as you say, it showed this was actually counterintuitive, because right. People think, what's the excuse that people have for, I want to try it out, I want to make sure it's the right thing, right? I mean, that in itself is open to abuse, but if you're going in with the attitude, I want to make sure that the other one is okay, right? That's already a bad thing, because the thing that we should be focusing on is, am I okay? Not the other one, but we don't work that. And unfortunately, what they showed conclusively, it's not even a suffix of all. The more, in other words, the likelihood of divorce is significantly greater if the couple lived together before they got married, because of the fact they're going in with the wrong attitude, which gets to the very point, the most important. The first ethical point is, I'm in it till the end, no matter what. I'm sure I hear you asking it, even though you're not saying it, well, what if it really is bad? But what if? I mean, there are a lot of what ifs, right? And I'm not dismissing them and saying they're insignificant, but if we went in with this attitude from the very outset, the divorce statistics would be a lot less. The question that probably you're asking me is, well, how are we doing on marriage and divorce in the Jewish community? The truth of the matter is that we don't have really good statistics.
We don't have good statistics, or statistics aren't good?
We don't have good ones, and if we had them, they wouldn't be good. Right. So the general feeling is, you know, what's doing amongst the Christians is doing amongst the Jews, right? There was a time that the divorce rate was heading towards 50%. Like one in two marriages was going to work. The idea of marriage being a 50-50 proposition, that was not what we had in mind. But the idea that there's only a 50% chance that it would work, apparently there's been a slight improvement, but I'm not too excited about that improvement, because in effect, what is happening in general society is that the time that a couple are normally together has been severely reduced. People are getting married a lot later in general, even amongst the Jewish community of the religions. We're the ones that get married the latest. And in spite of what you know about Brooklyn and Borough Park and Williamsburg, we have on average less children per couple. In fact, the Jewish community in general is not even hitting zero population growth. And if you factor in the idea that in some places they have 8 or 9 as a general rule, or 10, so this is really a scary statistic. So more on that maybe in some other situations that or topics that we will be addressing later on in the course of this conference. So first important principle is that, and it's a mental thing, that if something comes up, we're going to work it out. Not, we'll see if it works out, and if not, I walk. And that's something that is absolutely fundamental, because it works on your mind, so that the framework in which you approach any problem is one which is as logical as, for example, if I have a problem with one of my arms, there's no option for taking the other arm to cut off this arm to avoid the problem, right? That's a silly and absurd thing, and that is a dynamic should be working in marriage. You would no more think about severing a limb to solve a pain issue because that's not the way we work. So this, I know, is a famous Yerushalmi with regard to the issue of not taking revenge, but when you are in a situation of you and your wife are as one, that has to be the operating dynamic. It's interesting, the Rabbeinu Bechaya in Kara Kemach makes the proposition, which is totally absurd based on what's in the Torah, because we know from the Torah that there is an out clause in marriage, which thankfully it's good that we have that, because we don't want to ever pin a person into a situation where they're stuck forever. I can get into that a little bit more, into the dynamics of it, because it has resulted in disparity in the relationship, which was not the original intent. If you want, I can go, I'll just give you a quick thing on this. We know that according to biblical law, a husband can divorce his wife against her will. You know that, right? You're all aware of that. Unfair, right? We also know that a husband can have more than one wife, biblically, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. A little bit ridiculous, but allowed. So the question is, why is this? Well, let me just give you a quickie on this. The law of having more than one wife was actually intended not for the husband, but for the wife. Because I think it was a generally accepted proposition that within a population, it's more likely that you'll have more women than you'll have men. For the simple one word, war. In war, it was the men that got killed. So the likelihood is that you'd have less men than women. On the other hand, the Torah says, pru urvu, that everyone should be fruitful and multiply. Let's discount for the moment whether it applies to women. But simply speaking, how are you going to get married when it's a one-to-one relationship? There's simply not enough to go around. Sociologically, it just simply doesn't work. So the Torah basically said, we're going to open up this possibility that, and it's all based on consent. In other words, we'll open up the possibility of a man having more than one wife. If the woman wants to do this, by the way, even today in the Yemenite community where they have this, the ketubah reads that it's only on the if the first wife agrees to it. In other words, depending on what the nature of the relationship is. But assuming that is the case, why would a woman go into this? My assumption is because she would prefer a relationship in which she's looked after, even though it's a half a husband that she has, or a third of a husband, or a quarter of a husband. So it's not only quarter horses that we have, we also have quarter husbands. The Torah didn't say you should do it, but the Torah also didn't say you can't do it. So if a person is so inclined that for her financial security is important, then go for it. We're not going to stand in your way. Here's an interesting thing.
So why did Rabbeinu Gershon?
I'm coming there. Right, I'm getting there. Right, good. So basically, though, here's the problem. If a guy is doing this because he can afford it, because otherwise the woman can go into it, you know, you have enough to support more than one, fine. What happens if the guy all of a sudden goes poor and he can't support him? He's stuck. So if we're going to say that he's stuck, that means that we're in bad shape, because no guy is going to do something like this if he knows that if the business fails or whatever, that he's going to have this on his shoulders to have to support all these wives. So therefore, Torah-wise, the Torah said where the out clause is, that if a husband can't afford it, so he is given the permission to divorce his wife against her will. Comes Rabbeinu Gershom, and later on, he actually got it. It's like actually quite brilliant. And he said, look, this all applied if the marriage was one to many, right? If you have one husband, many wives. But what he did at that time was he made two simultaneous decrees. Number one, in line with what was going on in the society at the time, husband can only have one wife at a time. And then he said, no more divorce against her will. Because he understood this. He said, the whole idea behind it was in order to make this option viable, because if the option is not viable, it's not an option altogether. But now that that option is off the table, there's no reason to have a disparity between husband and wife. And later commentaries actually say very clearly that the intent of Rabbeinu Gershom was to equalize the relationship between the husband and the wife. So we can understand that when a husband had many wives, it wasn't equal, as you know very well from the story of Yaakov and his wives. But later on, the intention was to equalize and to normalize and put them on the same level. Getting back to this issue. So the question now is, what other ethical responsibilities impact into the marriage? So if we say you have to work on it to make sure that it's going to last through, but there are also important strategies to say, okay, I got it that I have to that I have to go in with the attitude that it is forever. And going back to the Kana Kemach, I think I lost focus for a second. So Rabbeinu Bachya says that even though it's clear in the Torah that you can have this outpost, he says that a husband and wife are forbidden to divorce. So you say, how can you say that when the Torah is very clear that you have this divorce option? So we'd have to say that his categorical expression of this is to really sort of convey the idea that once you're married, you're really inseparable. This is the way you should be. And even though there is this out clause, we said, you know, for all intents and purposes, forget about the out clause, just consider the in clause, which is you're in it forever, and that's the way you should be. Going a little bit further now, one of the major important components in marriage is to make your partner the priority. That's an ethical responsibility. To be blunt and truthful, when you have this situation, okay, who does what and where does the primary responsibility rest? Because of the fact that the husband's position was a little bit more dominant, and that's basically maybe an understatement, that really meant that he had greater responsibility. Because of the fact that you had all of these, a lot of things that came through in Laurie's conversation, what it means is that in the husband-wife relationship, you have almost the reliving of the Talmudic law that a person whoever, don't jump to conclusions on this, but whoever, let's say, acquires an Eved, acquires a master. In other words, you think that when you have an Eved that you can actually boss that Eved around and do whatever, make sure that they do whatever they want. Actually, what you have actually acquired is a master, because the obligations that you have towards the Eved are so onerous, and they because of the fact that you are in a position of power, that position of power actually makes you powerless. It's quite an interesting thing. So even though truthfully in most situations of abuse in a marriage, they come from man to woman, and this is something that may surprise you, the incidence of abuse in marriages actually increases the more fundamentalist the relationship is. So you should not be surprised if you find, for example, on situations of abuse in marriages, and our best estimates are that 1 in 4 marriages have abuse in it, that the more religious, the more likely. Because they say, I have all this power, but it's a distortion. Because in fact, what it says, if you have the power, that means you have the power to make it work. And that's a power that you're not allowed to abuse. But we've lost that in terms of our transmission of responsibilities that husbands have towards wives. So what I'm going to tell you now is basically almost one-sided. It's not that the wife doesn't have responsibilities in the marriage, but when it comes to the bottom line of who has to make the first move for reconciliation, if there's a difficulty, it's on the shoulders of the husband. So he is the one that has to make sure that this reigns. So for example, you look at the Torah. The Torah says that there's an obligation, Noki Yela Beito Shana Echot, right? That when a person gets married, he has to be innocent to his house for 1 year. Innocent of what? innocent of dereliction of responsibility. So no one can say, you know, you didn't do what you had to do. So what did you have to do? You had to be attentive. You had to make sure that you understood your wife and all of the rhythms of her behavior throughout the entire year so that you really get it. Does that mean that the wife doesn't have to do that too? No. But the primary responsibility is the man's towards the wife. It's very clear. The Torah says, Noki yel beito shanai chasen, and says, V'simach et ishto, ashalokot. And then he has to gladden his wife. Now, to say to gladden his wife, that's a tall order, but it's a sublime responsibility. So I'm going into marriage and saying my obligation is to make sure that my wife is happy. That's a responsibility. I'm not making it up. The Torah says it very clearly. And lest you say, okay, after the year you don't have to make her happy because that's all the Torah said. Unfortunately, all of the commentaries say the first year is the important year, but the simach is forever. The obligation that you have to make your wife happy doesn't end at any point in time. Your responsibility to her lasts, and that obligation to make her happy is never ending. That's a paradigm in marriage that I don't know if it doesn't get taught that much in color classes. You would know that probably better than me, but the idea that a guy is going and saying your obligation is to make your wife happy, and that's it's written in there. It's not optional. It's fundamental and basic to the relationship. So how do you make your wife happy? So there's all sorts of dimensions of the marital relationship, but if you want to put it in simple graphic terms, it means she is your priority. That's it. She is your priority. When you talk about always ishto kegufo, that's basically the fulfillment of the biblical obligation of ahavta l'reacha kamocha, right? Think about it for a moment. The Torah says you have to love your rea like yourself. Impossible. How do you actually do that? That means if I love my fellow, if I translate it in its generally accepted way, which is that it applies to society at large, how in heaven's name am I ever going to be able to fulfill that? To love everyone like myself means in the morning before I eat breakfast, I have to make sure everybody else has breakfast. Before I put clothing on, I have to make sure everyone else has clothing on. It's ridiculous. It's impossible to actually fulfill. But if you take a look in the Gemara, all over the place, it's very clear that the word rea is referring to your wife. So there are many instances of it. I'll just give one of them, which had to do with what Laurie raised about looking at your wife. So there's a prohibition. I know you're laughing at it, but it says a prohibition. You're not allowed to marry a woman unless you actually have seen her. So that maybe gives you the idea that in some places the wife was not seen, which I think is obscene, but in a sense the Torah basically said, basically the Gemara says you're not allowed to. And what's the basis for it? The basis for it is the Torah rule, v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. And we're afraid that if you marry someone unseen, and then you open up your eyes and see what you see, you don't like it, and you will then be nasty to her because of that, you transgress v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. You transgress the obligation to love your rea. Therefore, you have to see her beforehand. Now, we understand that seeing is not just, you know, having a shadchan send you a picture of her, or you have a quick look. It means basically to know and to appreciate that this is something that's going to work. So, what does rea then mean? Rea means your spouse. When you hear in Sheva Brachot, Sameach Tesamach Re'im Hu Ahuvim, think of V'Ahavta L'Re'acha Kamocha. That Re'ah that we're talking about in the Bracha is your fellow, and there I can say very simply, L'Re'acha Kamocha means, yeah, in the morning when you get up, you got to make sure that your wife has what to eat even before you do. Perfectly well. If you actually translate this the way we understand it, and you apply it to your wife, then you're in good shape. I mean, that's a very good... Now, everybody knows that the Haftarah Re'acha Kamocha is the ethical basis of Judaism, right? It's actually even the theological basis of Judaism. We know that Zad Klal Godol B'Torah, you know, whatever Hillel's translation of it was what he told the prospective convert wanting to convert on one foot. So the idea of applying the Haftarah Re'acha Kamocha is essential to the marital union. And to go into the marriage knowing that this is the way you actually fulfill this biblical dictate, which is foundational of Judaism, and which is foundational to marriage. Again, I don't know how many people get taught that when they're going into chosen classes or kala classes. But it's absolutely critical, because it's so fundamental, so self-understood, but it's also such a wonderful paradigm with which to work. So what does it mean wife is a priority? So I think the first time I suggested this, it sounded almost like a joke. But I have repeated it enough times that I actually believe it. And I don't even think it's funny, but important, which is like this. What's the normal pattern of a guy when he's going to work? Gets up in the morning, takes a shower, shaves, depending on, right? Goes to work. Looks great at work, comes home, basically 8, 9, 10 hours, tired, probably a little bit schwitzy from riding the train or whatever the case may be, and comes home and dresses like a schlump and everything is fine, right? What would be if we reversed it? Not that you go to work as a schlump, but let's say when you come home, that's when you take a shave, that's when you take a shower, and that's when you say to your wife, here I am. Clean, clean shaven, all good, because you are my priority, not the boss at work. You are my priority. If we change that simple little thing, because we talk about, yeah, my wife's a priority, fine, but okay, tangibly, how can you do that? Yes, sir?
I just going to say, just a couple of weeks ago, I was reading, I mentioned it in Shul and Mashiach,
yeah, okay.
For Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, those words.
Right.
When Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he was going up to the steps of his house. He was walking with somebody, and he's breaking his spine and everything. I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm going home for my wife. I want to make sure I'm dressed appropriately. So he did. And you know, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the famous story at the funeral of his wife, he says, normally we ask for a mechila
right. For
the person that we're married for, whatever, over 60 years. We never had an argument. You know, I don't have anything to ask for a mechila from his wife. I mean, only Rav Shlomo Zalman could say such a thing. But
great, perfect. Yeah, sir.
How about today where a lot of women are working and a lot of women are working today and their priority may be they're a doctor, they're a surgeon, they're a lawyer, whatever, and you know they're as busy as the men. So
100%. So remember what I said before, the primary onus is on the man, but that doesn't mean that it's a one-way street. In other words, in terms of the issue of who has the ultimate responsibility, somebody has to do it, right? Because each one can say, it's not me, it's you. So we're very clear in the delineation of the responsibilities. By the way, go back a little bit. We don't give a lot of attention to the things that are said under the chuppah, mainly the reading of the ketubah, which, by the way, in certain circles, you know, where you fight in shul about who gets shlishi and who gets shishi. So if there would be fights in certain Hasidic circles, the fight is over who gets to read the ketubah. Not the seventh bracha. The ketubah is the number one honor. Not even the Sidur Kiddushin. Because that's an interesting little myth too. After Kiddushin, you're not even married. So this is the ultimate honor that is given for the rabbi to order the Kiddushin. So after the ring is put on the finger, they're just betrothed. They're not married. They still have to do something in order to get married. What that is, depending, according to many, it's the brachot that unite them in marriage, and others say it's the yichud that does it, but they're not really married. But so what does it say in the ketubah? There's a word in there which is absolutely, looks like it's priceless. Va'ano, he says, in in the ketubah we have the thing about I'm going to support you according to the way Kirtos Guven Yehudoi, basically according to the way Jewish gevers, which is not husbands but persons, are supposed to do. But the first words are Va'ano Ekor. Ekor. Ekor is from the word Yakar. You know what that means? That in the ketubah document, the husband is undertaking to render his wife as precious, to keep her as Yakar. How many people know that? The idea that I've made an undertaking when I'm getting married, that I have an obligation that my wife is precious. I'm not getting into the pedestal stuff about that, but the idea that that I do this, it's a legal responsibility. You say it in there. Unfortunately, it gets lost in translation. People don't really give much attention to it when they're hearing it at the marriage, at the wedding. And unfortunately, I'm not even aware of the fact that this is part of their responsibility. So when you have a Masada Kedushin, and I would assume that they all take it seriously, they'll tell the husband about the fact that, you know, when you're getting married, you have to support, you have to provide house, you have to provide clothing, you have to provide wherewithal. Do they also say you have to provide preciousness? I don't hear it, but that's what it says. And that's what we should be doing. Because, and then what then happens is that that translates into an ethical responsibility. If I've undertaken this, and this is something that I've done as part of the document, the deal that I made, that's what I have to keep it. That's my obligation. So, decorating for one's wife, I remember years ago there was a wit who said something like this. He said, it is true that many marriages have collapsed because the guy went out to lunch with a co-worker. But it's probably more true that marriages collapsed because the guy had breakfast with his wife. Which was a reflection on, okay, Schlepper Ahin, you should understand this. So there's a little bit of a balance here. No, it doesn't mean that there should be a pressure situation, but we've been so skewered in the other direction to say, for the outside, we got to be okay, and for the inside. And that has to do, by the way, not only with the way we dress, but also with behavior. If we think about it for a moment, we're less likely to explode in anger to our boss at work or a co-worker than we are to our cohort in life. And as to the excuse that, well, she or he is a part of my corpus, so we're as one, when was the last time you saw people getting angry at themselves? And I would say, okay, if you get angry at yourself so much, and that's your excuse for why you get angry at your wife, that's fine, but I don't know that that ever happens. And it basically it's more like a taking for granted. It's certainly not an acor. It's not I am holding you precious, because you're doing just the opposite. So this is all part and parcel of the obligation that we have. It's a sacred obligation, something which unfortunately we've lost. What I'm going to do is I just want to, there's a lot more. I want to focus in a little bit on some other things. For example, Rabbi Akiva Eger, great sage, apparently he spent a lot of time learning with his wife. And he writes actually something poetically beautiful. He says, I learned with a lot of people. I learned with my Talmidim. I learned from Rabbeim. I learned all over. He says, the time that I spent with my wife was the most important time in my life, because I learned from her what Yirat Shemayim really means, the awe of heaven. In other words, he said this was not just a tokenism. He said, I looked forward to this all the time, because learning with her was an ennobling situation. It's just the opposite of Altaba Sicha Imaisha that we started out with. Basically saying, no, my wife is my learning partner. One of the major issues in marital ethics is something which we would probably not on our own put into that category, but that's the nature of the sexual relationship between husband and wife. Rabbi Yaakov Emden makes a very interesting observation. He says that the Shulchan Aruch chapter that has all of this business about the husband's relationship with his wife of a sexual nature is Resh Mem, which in Hebrew is 240. He makes a very interesting observation. He says, Resh Mem in Hebrew means Rome, which is exalted. But if you turn the letters around and you make it Mem Resh, then it's Mar, then it's bitter. And he makes a fascinating observation. He said, this is a time of ultimate togetherness between husband and wife, which if not done correctly, can end up being very bitter. Take a look, for example, at the word that we use for describing it. We call it ona. The word ona actually means the time, her time, right? Which means that when we say it's her time, it's also her persona. So the idea that we're not allowed to stare at our wives, not that we're not allowed to look at them, but not allowed to stare. We don't want husbands to objectify the wife and say, this is my chattel that I can do with what I want. The idea of ona being her sacred time, if you switch it around, what's the word that we have in Hebrew for affliction? It's inui. And you have this concept going on all the time because this is a type of a situation, unlike, let's say, another mitzvah. For example, if I put on tefillin, but my mind was somewhere else, I'm not saying it's a good thing to do, but the stakes are not that, you know, after that this set of tefillin have been defiled. It's not as if you brought it into a latrine or anything like that. And then, however, when it comes to this, which is a mitzvah, which is part of the biblical obligation of the simach, if we do not do it right, if this is not approached with the delicacy and the love and the self-transcendence that is demanded, in other words, I'll put it in blunt terms, if the husband is going in just to get his own thrills, he's not concerned about the feelings of his wife, this turns the Rome to a Mar. This turns a mitzvah into an Avera. It turns what has been described in the Igeret HaKodesh, which is attributed to Ramban, whether he wrote it or not, in those days, if they wanted a book to sell, they put a different author on it, that people would say, oh, okay, Ramban wrote it, I'll buy it. And he wrote in the Igeret HaKodesh that this is the most sacred and holy of human expressions. The togetherness and the oneness that comes from a husband and wife as a sexual nature is the holy of holies. And he goes on to develop how why is it that the Shabbat is the ideal time for it? So our sociological excuse for it would be because Shabbat is when we're not going to work, so we're relaxed, we don't have, the telephone can ring, we don't answer it, the computer is off, hopefully, and all sorts of other things. But he says, no, it's more than that. Shabbat is the holiest day of the year, of the week, actually also the holiest day of the year, and we have the conjugal union on Friday night is holy encountering holy. In other words, in the ambiance of holiness, which is what Shabbat is supposed to be, where you're not running and it's all about me, 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 it's about sanctifying the day. So what more beautiful preparatory for the sacred relationship between husband and wife than to have it in the ambience of holiness? All part of our ethical obligations, not just simply a technique situation here. It's a question of, when I'm going into marriage, am I equipped in this idea? Do I know this is why I'm doing it? Do I fully appreciate this is my sublime responsibility as we're entering into this union? So we can spend a lot of time on this, but I also want to tell you something quite interesting. Think, is there anything in this world for which there is no bracha? So you want to have water, there's a bracha, right? You want to have beer, there's a bracha, right? You want to shake a lulav, there's a bracha, right? Is there a bracha for sex? No. I mean, you can say, hold it a minute, there's no bracha for tzedakah. True. But what would be the excuse of why there's no bracha for sex? I don't know. It's one of the, if it's the highest of all pleasures, there should be a bracha for it. So the excuse might be, in the same sense as, for example, the timing might be a problem, about exactly when. You don't want to interrupt in the middle, right? So, but for example, with tzedakah, we say, you know, how do you know that the poor is going to accept? So you can make a bracha on something which is not in your hands, because tzedakah only becomes it not when you give it, but when someone else accepts it. So it's not in your hands, therefore, to make a bracha. But hold it a minute. There is the observation of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, which, by the way, I highly recommend a few books if you want to learn about the sanctity of the union, which should be basic in every Hasan and Kala class. One of them is Igeres HaKodesh is great. Mitos HaKesef of Rabbi Yaakov Emden in his Siddur. It's a Friday night Siddur, phenomenal. And then there is the chapter in Seder Kedusha of the Raivat, which is absolutely phenomenal. All of these are great sources for what this is all about. But Rabbi Yaakov Emden says, you know, in the bracha that you have when you say the Shema HaMapil, right? That appealing bracha, right? So it says there are four words in it, which is Utehi Mitati Shalema Lefanecha. May my bed be complete before you. He says that's a bracha for sexual union. So we got around this issue very interestingly. We don't have a separate bracha for it, but it's incorporated in a bracha that we would say anyway, so that in fact when a person is saying Hamapil at night, this is the intention he should be having, if in fact this is the intention. So you say to me, hold it, is this romantic that I'm doing this to fulfill a mitzvah? It is, if you're doing it right. In other words, if I'm going in saying this is my sacred responsibility, and you have a full awareness of the breadth of that responsibility, then you're not tooting. That is as romantic as it gets. Because you're going in there saying, my job, my task, is to make sure that in this experience, my wife feels endeared, precious. Ethical responsibility. Jewish marriage ethics, that's what it's all about. Let me end. Okay, are we okay time-wise?
Yeah.
Okay. So
5 minutes.
What?
Up to 5 minutes.
All right, so I know that you need a break between this one and the next one. So one observation I want to make to you is as follows. The idea that I mentioned about marriage being forever. So I have done a book called Jewish Marriage, Halachic Ethic. I've also, on balance, had another book called Jewish Divorce Ethics. There's an ethic of divorce, too, which, again, is honored in neglect in probably in all circles. We know from the Gemara, actually it's based on the Pasuk in Yeshaya, which says, "Umi b'sorcha al tisalam." He says, from your own flesh, you should not be oblivious. And basically, the Gemara tells us what this means is not what we think it means. Because why would a person, let's say, be oblivious to their children? Even so, they wouldn't. So why are we being told something that's totally ridiculous because we know that this is what we would be doing? Said this is a reference to our ex-wife. In other words, a person that was once v'hayula basar echad, and now you're divorced. You're divorced, but your responsibility to her, you can't be oblivious. And this is the basis for a Jewish divorce ethic, which is to say that for whatever reason it happened, but once you're split, it doesn't mean that it's gone. And your responsibilities ethically to your ex have not all of a sudden instantaneously disappeared. But that's more for another time. But let me bring you to a conclusion on a very good basis. You know the Ish Tzadik in Yerushalayim? He has a wonderful line. There was once a time that his wife had a pain in the foot, so they went to the doctor. You probably have heard this because it's used a lot, but it's very important for us to feel this. So they went to the doctor, and the tzaddik of Yerushalayim said to the doctor, "My wife's foot hurts us." If we get to that point that each one's pain is felt by the other, that's a good sign and a good indication that each one's joy will be felt by the other. And that's what a good marriage is all about. And that's our ethical responsibility to do what we can to make it happen. Thank you very much.
Questions we can take for a minute or two. A couple minutes of questions. The other group's not quite finished yet either. So if there are any quick questions for both or for Lori, Bakasha. Otherwise, we'll take about a 20-minute break and we'll reconvene just to let you know in your booklet. Yep. But in this room, Lori will be talking about what a U.S. and Halakha does, what are the other questions does, and she'll give you many of the examples. Frontier and halakha Judaism, if I can call it that. And in the back room, it will be a new frontier, something like organ transplantation, paying for organs, choosing who should go to organs. Rabbi Booker will be speaking there too, as you know, he's the head of the Trillium Society for Organ Donations here. Dr. Benzo, Rabbi Gladden, Rabbi Stockman. So that will start at approximately 11:20. There's food to eat in case anybody's hungry out in the hall. Want to get Shabbos candles, books, shmooze, have a nice time.
So, in this generation of the me generation, I was just having this conversation with my 19-year-old son yesterday in the car, exactly about this, about relationships with women. And the me generation is all about me, and the priorities are about me. How, as parents, I mean, how do we prepare our children, or are we doing a good job of preparing our men, our young men, our boys, to serve, you know, to serve others, specifically the wife?
So we have a basic, fundamental, and beautiful Hillel statement about me, which is Imena Nili Mili, right? Me generation, if I am not to myself, who will be for me? Which is basically a nice thing to say. We begin with the idea that you have to look after yourself. But then he goes very quickly into Kishaniva Atzmi Moani, but if I'm for my own self, what am I? In other words, me is part of us, but if you really want to be a good partner to anyone, you have to know what it takes to go from me to we. And that's in any type of a relationship, whether it's in a work situation. If I'm in it, you know, in order to make all the money in the world that I want, but I'm not in it in order to do the best job for people that need me, that's a we situation. Most relationships are basically we of different types. And one of the things how you measure success in all of these things is how well you've graduated from me to we. In marriage, it's clear that if you stuck on me, the marriage could last, but it's not thriving. A marriage can last because each one's interests, they coalesce, right? You ever hear this thing about people saying we outgrew each other or whatever the case may be? And it wasn't as if they were fighting, but neither one was really invested in the other. They were invested in themselves, and it turned out, yeah, fine. How many times have you heard about the wife who works at a crazy pace in order to put bread on the table so that her husband can go and get a PhD or an MD or whatever. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, after he's gotten a degree, he says, it's nice knowing you. And you say, hold on, where's your gratitude? Which is, I think, one of the important things to express in marriage, gratitude on a regular daily basis. So where's your gratitude? Well, I said, no, this is what I needed at the moment. And this is what you gave me. It's all about me, and you don't say it that way, but now I'm good. So relationships don't thrive on a me basis. And in case he doesn't believe you, there are many books out there that will reinforce the point. Right.
What did you say? You have three resources that you mentioned. What are those three that were very
different? Yeah. They're all in my book, Jewish Marriage and Halakha Gathering. Seriously. So as you get one book, it has it all in there. But it's the Rav Yaakov Emden's Pirush on the Siddur for Friday night. Then you have the Raivat's work. It's called Balei HaNefesh. So in the last chapter of Balei HaNefesh is about about the marital union, about the conjugal part of it, right? And you know that the Ravad was a type of fellow who inspired people to argue with him. So one of the people who normally argued with him said, on that chapter is so beautiful, I cannot say a word against it. That's how good it was. And then the other one is the Holy Letter, the Igeret HaKodesh. The Holy Letters were translated.
Okay.
Yeah. In English. Well, but because I dealt with it in that, and it's not the only one. Jewish Way in Love and Marriage by Maurice Lamb is also a good book. That's a good book, a very good book. Can you think of any more, Jay? It's a nicely written book on
A Hedge of Roses.
Hedge of Roses is good. That's the other lamb.
Correct.
Right. That's the Norman lamb. What? Can't hear. Marital Intimacy, yeah, right. And then Ada Hans has a good book. Miriam Ada Hans is a good, I don't know the title of it. There's a lot. There's a Pirkei and Haggadah Bayit of questionable view. There's stuff like Shlomo Wolbe wrote a lot of stuff in Hebrew that is really good, but it's all quoted in that famous book.
There's a Jewish marriage.
A halachic ethic.
Okay, the refreshments are out in the hall. And
by the way, you know what? It's a good question you asked me. I don't know if they changed the title in the second edition. Oh, Shlomo. Anyway,
I'll look it up.
So why do you all right. Okay. Thank you, ladies.
Okay, thank you.